You're listening to a podcast edition of Closer to Truth. For more information about this series, visit our website, closertotruth.com.
Hi, I'm Robert Lawrence Kuhn, host of Closer to Truth. For more deep discussions of cosmology, consciousness, the multiverse, free will, scientific breakthroughs, raw existence, and much more, I invite you to become a member by signing up at closertotruth.com. Registration is totally free, and you'll get benefits like early access to new episodes, tailored video recommendations, discounts on events and programs, and inside updates via our email newsletters. Again, sign up for free membership at closertotruth.com and click on Join. We appreciate your support of Closer to Truth, and we're excited for you to see what we've got coming up this year. Welcome to Closer to Truth. I'm speaking with philosopher Paul Thagard, who focuses on cognitive science, philosophy of mind, and philosophy of science, about his profound, probative, engaging, and highly relevant book, Bots and Beasts, What Makes Machines, Animals, and People Smart. It is the first systematic comparison of intelligence across machines, humans, and other animals. Welcome, Paul. I'm really looking forward to our discussions. It's good to meet.
Nice to meet you.
So before we dig into Bots and Beasts, which we'll do in quite depth, let's talk briefly about your latest book, Falsehoods Fly, Why Misinformation Spreads and How to Stop It. You say that effective responses to these problems, which we know is terribly extant today, require understanding how information is generated and spread. How so?
Well, in order to stop misinformation, we need to know what makes it different from information. And so we need to know what information is. There's an old mathematical theory called information theory that uses probabilities that's fine for different kinds of electronic communication, but doesn't apply to the kinds of information and misinformation that are so important in the world right now. We need this for science, for medicine, for politics. And for that, we need to have an idea of misinformation that can actually be about the world. It can be about the world, but also it can get twisted and get twisted by politicians or people who are denying science or who are selling bad medical cures. It can get twisted in lots of different ways. And so we really need a theory of information and misinformation that could apply to all these incredibly practically important areas.
Good. So how do you do that? I mean, you've developed in the philosophy of science a theory based on explanatory coherence and the difference between something that coheres and incoheres regarding specific relationships between elements of the content. Does that apply?
Sure, that's part of it. So I call it my theory of information, the Ames theory, because I identify four classes of mechanisms. They're acquisition, inference, memory, and spread. Well, inference is the best explanation, or explanatory coherence is relevant to the inference part. So. The acquisition is what you do in getting the information in the first place from the world or from just making stuff up. I mean, the typical difference there is we use in science observations and instruments and experiments to get good information collected from the world. But then we need to go beyond that to develop theories. And for that, we need to have good kinds of inference. But you see big differences now between inference, between information and misinformation. In acquisition, you try to get things from the world. In misinformation, you just make things up because it suits your goals. People do that all the time. In inference, we should use something like explanatory coherence, which says consider all the evidence and come up with the best theory and consider all the alternative theories. But for misinformation, by far the most common psychological pattern is called motivated reasoning. It's just people believe things because it makes them happy. It suits well with their particular desires or their particular greed. And so that's a huge difference. And the huge spread of misinformation in the world is really spread by people's greeds and motivated inference rather than by explanatory coherence with respect to all the relevant evidence.
What about what we call confirmation bias, where you seek out that which confirms what you already believe or would like to believe? I mean, I see it in myself. I'll have difficulty reading articles that show how Russia is winning in Ukraine, and I'll strive to find those articles that
show that Ukraine is winning in some way. And it's an obvious confirmation bias that I have.
Well, confirmation bias is definitely one of the factors, but I think motivated reasoning is even more powerful, because it's believing not just because you already did believe it, but because you want to believe it, because it makes you happy, or it suits your goals to believe it. So both of those go together. But of the two, I think that motivated reasoning is by far the most powerful, and it probably is responsible for more misinformation than sheer confirmation bias. Because the question is, why does somebody have the idea in the first place? It could be because they had some good method of acquisition, but most often somebody made something up and got spread to you, and they liked it and you liked it because it fits with their personal goals, because it fits with their desire for money or fame or power. And so I think that motivated reasoning is more powerful than confirmation bias in explaining misinformation.
Well, it sounds like motivated is a cause of confirmation bias. I mean, they're not on the same level. That confirmation bias is more of a reaction, and motivated reasoning is how it begins in the first place.
Yeah, confirmation bias is more cognitive. Motivated reasoning is more emotional, because you've got these goals, and so you want to believe something because it makes you feel good to think that the politician you like can solve all of the world's problems.
Right. Can this help us distinguish science from pseudoscience, or is that a different kind of issue?
It's definitely connected, because what science does, first of all, is do a really good job of collecting information by the methods that have been developed over the last 1,000 years, including, I mentioned, observations, especially systematic observations, using instruments, which are really powerful, like telescopes and microscopes. And especially, and this is a relatively recent one, doing experiments where you control different factors. And so that enables you to get at causality. So that's something the way science does, as opposed to just making stuff up. So this is very closely tied in with the difference between science and pseudoscience, which I think is quite profound.
Okay, let me give a more professional bio, and then we'll dig into the book. I'm very much looking forward to it. Paul Thagard is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at the University of Waterloo. He has contributed to the roles of analogy, creativity, inference, cognition in the history of science, and the role of emotion in cognition. In the philosophy of science, he uses computational models. In philosophy of mind, he applies connectionist models of coherence to theories of human thought and action, including a computer model of cognition that has emotions, which we'll talk about, at a fundamental level. So, Paul, let's talk about the book, Bots and Beasts, What Makes Machines, Animals, and People Smart. Let's start very briefly with the thesis of the book and the arc of the argument, very briefly, because we'll go in depth.
Well, I set out to do a systematic comparison. This actually grew out of a class I taught at the University of Waterloo, where I wanted to be able to introduce people from different fields to the different aspects of cognitive science. So I wanted the computer science students, which are a strong group at Waterloo, to know something about human psychology. And I wanted the psychologists and the philosophers to know something about how machine intelligence works. But it happened also at the time I had a graduate student who was working on animal cognition. I thought it would be interesting to get that in the mix. So I decided what I wanted to do was a comparison of both animal intelligence, that is non-human animals, and machine intelligence with what we know about human intelligence. So I set up a framework to compare all of them. My conclusion is complicated, because there's different aspects of intelligence, but I certainly concluded that none of the animals I was looking at come close to approximating human intelligence, although they do have certain elements of it. And I was looking at the current state of artificial intelligence when the book came out in 2021, and looked at a bunch of major AI programs and described the ways in which they fall short of human intelligence.
Right. And the natural question is, with large language modules, ChatGPT 4 and above, would that get a higher grade on some of the categories? You have a very nice grid in the book where you have a lot of different characteristics, and then give everybody the different kinds of animals, the different kinds of machines, grades, as if they were in your class from an A. No, I don't think anybody gets an A on any, where A is human, so human trivially get across the board A's because that's the definition. But basically from B to F, lots of mm-hmm. F's in your grading. Those students would be very unhappy.
Yeah, well, the report card has changed dramatically by the coming of these new models, ChatGPT and all the other large language models and generative AI. And I haven't redone my report card, but I've done lots of experiments with different AI systems. And frankly, I was quite astonished. It's only 18 months ago that the first ChatGPT came out. And it does things that I didn't think was going to be possible for decades. I never thought it was impossible. But I've been throwing at it problems in deductive inference, inductive inference, analogy, really explanatory coherence. And frankly, I'm just amazed at how good it is. And so the new report card would look actually quite different. I think the framework I set out in the book is still very valuable. And the concluding chapters about the ethics of AI are even more relevant because those issues have become much more concerning. But the abilities of ChatGPT compared to the AI that was available in 2021 strikes me as really, really astonishing. One of the things that's really amazed me is I was using ChatGPT for some of my research, and I said to it, okay, you're pretty good at answering questions, but real creativity comes from generating questions. But then I thought, wait a minute, maybe it can generate questions. So I asked it, I forget what the topic was. It was something like, what are good questions to ask about musical consciousness? Bam, maybe 15 great questions. And each of them, and then I got this, so I just started going systematically. I took the question number one and turned it into, and gave it to it. And then it answered that and gave me a good answer. And that then generated more questions. So I actually did a blog post on this. I've got a blog that gets a lot of views at Psychology Today. And so I did a blog post about this. And this method actually is an interesting way of doing research because you can use ChatGPT to do a lot of the thinking for you because it's really good at generating questions. Is there anything it can't do? Well, the main things that it still doesn't do that were a part of my list are things like emotions and consciousness, because I think those are part of intelligence. Animals have got emotions and consciousness, although not quite at our level, but we don't have any machines yet that have emotions and consciousness. So as things stand right now, I think these are real deficits. Why do I count emotions as part of consciousness or part of intelligence? Well, it's because it's a huge part of human intelligence. We often think that there's intelligence on one side and emotion on the other. And I've heard people say, don't be emotional, be intelligent. Well, that's just a really bad view of intelligence. What emotion does is evaluation. It's constantly allowing the brain not just to try to figure out what's true, but also to figure out what's valuable, what's actually worth paying attention to. And so we need emotions, in fact, as a crucial part of human intelligence. And that's the big thing that's still missing in ChatGPT.
Okay, well, what I want to do now is to very carefully define some of the terms that you've been using. And the obvious one to start is the one that you have in the title, the word smart, because smart is sort of a popular term. And I'd like you to distinguish smart is the term you use, but what we call, you know, IQ, intelligence quotients, and then emotional intelligence, which has been a term used. Creativity, and then the word mind and consciousness. How do all of these articulate together?
Well, I guess we could start with Homer Simpson's theory of smart. I am so smart, SMRT, but that's not what you want, something deeper than that. So I use smart as a synonym for intelligence. So what's intelligence? An equally dumb definition of intelligence is one that was proposed 100 years ago. Intelligence is what intelligence tests measure. Well, that's just dumb. We need something deeper than that. And so the definitions usually aren't terribly useful. What we need is a theory. So what I did is to break intelligence down into 12 features that could be explained by 8 mechanisms. So typically, definitions don't do a lot of work, but theories do a lot of work. So what's a scientific theory? In some fields like physics or mathematical equations, which is valuable, but often in biology and cognitive science, a theory is a description of mechanisms. So I identified what I think are the 8 mechanisms that are mainly responsible for humans being intelligent, different kinds of reasoning and emotion and problem solving and learning. So that's what I think intelligence is. It's better described not by a simple definition, which usually tend to be trivial or circular, but by identifying the mechanisms that are responsible for that. It's the same technique that I used for information. What are the mechanisms that make information good or bad? And what are the mechanisms that make people capable of doing smart things? And so we can do things like problem solving and learning by using different kinds of mental representations, by using concepts and rules and analogies. And so we can get an account of what goes on in the human brain when it produces things that are intelligent. So that's, I think, the best way to get at intelligence, by producing a theory rather than a definition.
Okay, understand the approach to intelligence in terms of that a grid of characteristics as opposed to a definition. That makes great sense, and the book articulates that very well. I enjoyed that part very much. How about these bigger terms that we use of mind and consciousness? And defining it, again, without circularity.
Well, that's really hard. People tend to think that definitions should be really clear and non-circular, but they aren't. In fact, if you follow words through a dictionary, you'll find yourself in circuits. So what you need is a theory of concepts here. And I've developed that with some of my colleagues. So what I prefer rather than definitions is to do something that involves three different things. Can we give standard examples? Can we give typical features? That's not defining features, but typical features. And then can we indicate how this is supposed to play an explanatory role? And in the case of consciousness, the typical features include things like an experience that's inner, that's subjective, that's qualitative. And so those are all the sorts of things that are typical features of consciousness, stuff that we're aware of. But that's not very satisfying. Again, for consciousness, I think we need a theory. In the book I'm writing right now, in fact, I give a mechanistic theory. I claim that consciousness in humans and animals results from four mechanisms: neural representation, binding, coherence, and competition. And so that is my answer to what consciousness is. It's the result of these four mechanisms. And that's what gives us these characteristics that are hard to describe, of how we have this inner experience that's hard to describe or share with anybody else and that involves awareness. That's all very vague. But the four mechanisms are extremely clear. We've got good evidence that all of them operate in the human brain. And I show that all of them work for the most important and interesting thing that people do, including dreams and jokes and songs. So that strikes me as a better way to approach these really deep problems rather than try to give definitions, because the definitions are always superficial or circular.
Okay, on consciousness, we'll get into that discussion later in terms of characteristics of consciousness as opposed to what consciousness is and how that subjectivity comes about. I think there's a distinction, but we can argue about that later. Right now, though, between mind and consciousness, do you differentiate those? That seems like, you know, very arbitrary, fuzzy Venn diagrams that overlap a lot, but maybe have
some. Oh, we have to distinguish between mind and consciousness because a lot of our thinking is unconscious. This isn't a novel idea. I mean, certainly Freud and predecessors knew it. But now that we know so much about the brain, I mean, the brain has huge amounts of operations going on that aren't conscious at all. You've got 86 billion neurons approximately, and they're firing in parallel, and you're not aware of 99.99% of what it's going on. Consciousness is very narrow. Just what you think you're thinking about is just a very small amount of things going on in working memory. And so that's only just a few things, whereas all of that is just the tip of the iceberg compared to all the processing that's going on in your brain, the visual processing, auditory processing, emotional processing, all of that's going on. So the vast amount of what your mind is doing is in fact unconscious.
So but again, what you're doing is you're using the term mind to subsume all the other things that the brain does. That's what you're doing.
Problem solving and learning and really all the features of intelligence, as well as all the perceptual apparatus as well.
All the metabolic controls, all the hormonal controls. Yeah. Is that under characterized by mind? Because now you're dealing with mind and operations of the brain. You're not defining mind as all the operations of the brain, are you?
Well, all the ones that will be things that we could think about as eventually being conscious. Take, for example, I wrote a book on balance. And most of what we do in balancing is unconscious, but you can become aware of some of it if you're falling over or something like that. And so there's all this processing that's going on in your brain that deserves to be counted as part of mind because it's tied in with perception or problem solving or learning. And so you've got all those different characteristics, but consciousness is just a tiny part of that. It's a particularly puzzling part of that because it's so hard to observe. We're still trying to come up with theories of how it is that we have these feelings, we have these emotions, we have these experiences that include perceptions and sensations and even abstract thoughts, like wondering about consciousness. So all that's going on. But I think you see a mind as a much broader characteristic than intelligence, which is more, which is also broader than consciousness.
So to be simple, if we have set one being all the operations of the brain, then mind would be a subset of that. So there'd be some things in the brain that you would not characterize as mind, but mind would have a pretty big chunk of what's happening in the brain. And then consciousness would be a very small subset of what we would call mind. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's pretty good for talking about humans. Where it gets controversial is if you start thinking about machines, because ChatGPT and all the other AI programs that are around, they don't have brains at all. They run on computers. And so it's a controversial question whether mind is something that has to work on brains or whether it can work on these machines as well. So already we've got pretty smart machines around. Even driverless cars are just powerful computers. They don't have brains, but they do some aspects of thinking. They can definitely do problem solving and learning, for example.
Yeah. And again, that's a question of definition. I don't think there's a giant philosophical puzzle in it. It's just how you're defining the term in relationship to what the object, the target is doing. Consciousness, I think, has a bigger problem because there does seem to be something in consciousness that is not easily attributable to physicality. And we can talk about that later.
Well, historically, that's been true, but I'm hoping to change that with the new book, because I think, in fact, that we can say physically how consciousness arrives using these four different aspects of what the brain does. How that's going to apply over to ChatGPT if it gets closer to consciousness is still an open question. So I actually think there are deep philosophical and scientific questions here. It's not just a matter of definition. We got to figure out what actually are these large language models doing, and are they doing anything that's close enough to the basis for human consciousness that we might at some point want to attribute consciousness to them. We don't want to do it yet, but that could change. That could change in a matter of years because they're moving so rapidly.
All right, let's begin going through the book. We're not going to go through every chapter in detail, but I do want to focus in some areas. And chapter one is a very good place. It's attributing minds to machines and animals. And here is where you develop the methodology, the way of thinking, really, about how you're going to go about the process. You introduce it with what is intelligence. We've discussed that a little bit. And then give six smart machines, six smart animals, just to give some flavor. I ask you to do that a little bit. But what I do want to focus on is the mechanism that you use for the analysis, which will then be applied throughout the book, the attribution procedure and then the comparison procedure. These are the ways of thinking that you use throughout the book. So give a little bit of the flavor of the smart machines and the smart animals, and then let's delve into the two procedures.
Okay, first of all, with the attribution procedure, we've got to be very careful about what we assign intelligence to or consciousness to. I mean, there are people who want to argue that intelligence isn't just a property of the machines and animals I talk about, but even to much simpler things like plants or even cells. There's a book that just came out called The Sentient Cell that claims that every cell, every bacteria, you've got trillions of these in and on your body that are conscious. I think this is just a mistake. You need to have a standard that you can apply to figure out where consciousness begins. So we can start to look at what kinds of observations, what kinds of behaviors need to be explained by consciousness. Obviously, the big one is reports. So people can say, I feel happy, or I feel sad, or I can see you. So these are all the experiences that people report. But that's not a necessary condition because we can extend consciousness to other animals like cats and dogs, because a lot of their behaviors are similar to ours. It looks like they're in pain. And I think there's a good case to be made that they have emotions as well. That's something I argue later in the book. But we got to look at the ranges of behaviors that are best explained by attributing consciousness in mind. And that's why I think that that happens roughly at the level of certainly with mammals and birds, maybe fish and crustaceans and insects as well. And so we've got to have standards about what kinds of behavior are best explained by attributing intelligence and consciousness.
And so what are some of the specific categories of attribution that you use to ask those questions about the different levels in the biological hierarchy?
Yeah. So I give a long list of features that I mentioned, things like perceptions, things like, so if you look at a cell or a plant, it definitely has sensation. Not sensation, it definitely has sensing and signaling, but then so does the thermostat in my furnace. I mean, basically senses a temperature and then sends a signal to turn the furnace on. And you find lots of that in cells and plants as well. What you don't find is more complicated kinds of perceptions, the sort of thing we get with our eyes and our ears and our noses and tongues. And so you've got very complicated kinds of sensing of the world. But we can use that then to do more complicated things like solve problems, move around and do interesting things and make inferences as well. And so those are more complicated sorts of features and mechanisms that you find in animals and newish machines and in people that you don't find in just cells and plants.
Okay, and that gives you a way of thinking about where in the biological hierarchy what you're defining consciousness begins or cuts off. And I assume you would believe it's a gradual process or a step function, because that's another question in philosophy of mind or philosophy of consciousness. Most people believe that it's a gradient, but some think it there's a step function involved.
Well, it's a lot of it is still up in the air because people are finding new ways. I think the lowest in Bots and Beast I go down in attributing consciousness is possibly fish. But since that book was published, I read an interesting article about crabs and lobsters. And the authors, I thought, did a really remarkable job, these people from London and Bristol. And they established some really clear criteria for judging something to feel pain. Now, pain is a really good measure here because it's a sort of basic kind of consciousness. In humans, it's complicated because it's tied in with emotions, but at the very least, you know, everyone knows what it's like to feel pain. And there's good reason to believe, certainly, that mammals and birds feel pain, because if you damage a wing or a leg or something like that, its behavior is very similar. And on top of that, you can give it painkillers, and then that changes its behavior. On top of that, you know that these animals have nociceptors, that is, they've got the same kind of nerve cells that can detect damage. And you know that that can be affected also by using painkillers like opioids. And so the authors of this book on crabs and lobsters applied the same sorts of standards to what's known about crabs and lobsters, which I would have said before aren't conscious, don't actually experience pain, but they make a really strong case. So I'd extend my category of conscious entities to include crabs and lobsters, but I do it on the basis of evidence rather than on some hunch or intuition. I don't think hunches and intuitions are worth very much, but the evaluation of evidence by considering alternative theories is just the right way to go about this problem.
So just to be very specific, you're using the concept of pain as actually a step function in consciousness, because you're saying if you have pain, then you are conscious, as opposed to a gradient of consciousness relating to the pain.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it quite so categorical as a rule, because it makes it want to turn it around and say that somehow, I'd say having pain is a sufficient condition for being conscious, but it's not a necessary condition. You certainly find it in all animals that are conscious, but considering something like the new AI, the ChatGPT and the other generative AI models, they're moving toward becoming conscious, I think, but they may not have any nociceptors, and so they may not have any pain, even though they've got other kinds of conscious experiences.
Yeah, but once again, you're using consciousness in a very bimodal way. Either it's there or it's not. Is that what you're saying, that there is a point that consciousness would would occur, and if you can determine that the entity reacts to pain and has different behaviors, then that means it's conscious, or at the very bottom, is it a very slow gradient to come into consciousness?
Well, it's more complicated than talking about a gradient or a step function. So in the book I'm writing right now, I describe four different kinds of conscious experience. We get them from five different sorts of external perception and more than 10 different kinds of internal perception. So pain is one of those, but so is hunger, so is balance. So we've got all these kinds of things, but we've also got hundreds of different emotions. So if you're talking about emotion, is that the step function? I don't think so. I think it's rather these are three categories. And then there's a fourth category that humans have and maybe a few animals and maybe ChatGPT that would involve consciousness of abstract considerations, such as having a conversation about consciousness. So none of these is a step. These are just all different aspects of consciousness that a good theory has to be able to explain. And once you've got a good theory, then much more than a definition, you've got the basis to trying to figure out what's conscious and what's not.
Okay. Regarding AI, you talk about the burden of proof in these determinations of attributing mind to machines and animals. Where is the burden of proof, and how does that help us direct our focus?
Oh, the burden of proof is definitely on whoever is claiming that something is conscious. So if someone says every bacterium is conscious, they have to show that. They have to provide good arguments for that. If someone says, actually, this was a controversy in the last year. If someone says that Google's large language model is conscious, it's the burden of proof is on that person or on Google, whoever, to show that it's true. And I think if you look at the way those machines currently work, and the big advantage of the machines is we know what the algorithms are, we've got good reason to believe that they're not conscious. But the burden of proof is definitely on someone who wants to claim that an entity not previously known to be conscious is. So I think sometimes it's been answered very well. In the case of the paper I just mentioned about crabs and lobsters, the authors clearly knew they had to make a strong case. They did it by considering how pain works, and then they clicked off the boxes by showing that there was evidence for a lot of those boxes being checked. And so they have to make the case for it. Same thing for the machines. I don't think any machines we have now are conscious yet, but the burden of proof is on someone who wants to make that claim. In the case of the Google controversy, there was just some a Google engineer who got all caught up in conversations with the Google chatbot, which is easy to do because they're really, really quite smart. And he got taken in. He got misled. And so the alternative explanation is he simply got misled because the machine was so good at chatting with him. But given that we can open up the box to some extent, we know what it's doing. But that could change. I mean, the box is changing because people are getting better and better at making these kinds of generative AI programs. But the burden of proof is definitely on anyone who wants to claim that something is conscious. It starts with me. I mean, I know I'm conscious because I have this experience. How do I know that you're conscious? Well, it's a little harder, but I've got really good reason to believe that you're conscious because you've got behaviors that are very similar to mine. I can't stick a pin in you from this distance, but if I stuck a pin in you, you'd go yelp and you'd feel pain. I also have pretty good understanding of how human brains work. And so I know that you've got essentially the same machinery as me. So I've got good reason to believe that you and all the other 8 billion people in the world are conscious. It gets harder once you start getting into animals that are different kinds of brains and different kinds of behavior, but that work has been done quite thoroughly. And so that's why I'm really happy about saying that other mammals and birds are conscious. And now it's getting extended down to the level of bees as well. When I wrote Bots and Beasts, I basically just shrugged my shoulders. I'm not sure about bees. I'm not sure whether they're conscious. I'm not sure whether they have experiences. But since then, a really cool book came out by a leading bee researcher. It's called The Intelligent Bee or something like that. I don't know how I can't remember the exact title, but it was really smart. It was very comprehensive, gave good enough reasons to convince me, in fact, that bees are intelligent and quite likely have conscious experiences as well, even though they've only got about a million neurons. So we can do this on evidence. We can look at alternative explanations. We can consider what's the best explanation, what's most explanatorily coherent with everything we know about the situation, and reach quite reasonable judgments about what's conscious and what's not.
How do you differentiate the attribution procedure from the comparison procedure?
Okay, the comparison procedure has a different function. So the attribution just gets you going because you can think, oh, this thing's smart or not, or conscious or not. But the comparison procedure is, well, how do we actually compare humans to all these different animals or all these different machines? And that's where I think it was really useful that I broke intelligence down into the 12 features and 8 mechanisms, because that gives us 20 criteria. And so that's why we can compare all the different animals and all the different machines. I started off with a larger list of 10 of each, but that just got repetitive. So I boiled it down to 6 of each. We can do a comparison by seeing how do they rank with respect to their features and their mechanisms. And that's how I managed to give the report cards that you mentioned before. Those grades can change, as I said, as new information comes in. But at least that, I think, provides a useful framework that can be applied now to the more intelligent machines that are coming along, but also to animals that previously weren't thought to be very smart. One example that really surprised me is roosters. Roosters weren't thought to have a sense of self because they didn't pass the mirror test, which is one of the criteria for whether there can be a sense of self. But some clever researchers use a different aspect of roosters, which is that they tend to warn other roosters when there are threats. I thought this was really clever because so a hawk comes along and a rooster will squawk to another rooster, basically saying, watch out. So the question is, if a rooster is looking at itself in a mirror, will it squawk? And the answer, which really quite surprised me because I didn't think roosters were very smart, no, it doesn't squawk, which must mean it realizes that that rooster in the mirror is me. So this is another really clever behavioral way that you can use to try to get at what's going on in the brains of different kinds of animals.
And that can be distinguished between the overt characteristics of a mirror versus a real other entity. It seems like that conclusion seems a little bit glib unless there's other mechanisms to control it.
Well, they had to do lots of control also, but I'm not an expert on this kind of experiment, but it looked to me like it was well done, that the rooster looking in the mirror, if they put a mark on it, which is the more standard way these experiments does, it wouldn't start trying to get the mark off. It wouldn't get that. But if there was another rooster it saw in the mirror, well, it would be able to think in some form, that's not another rooster, that's just me. And so I'm no point in squawking because the eagle is coming after it. So there's a lot of really sophisticated work done in animal experimentation that expands, but it all fits with the kinds of criteria that I lay out, that is 12 features, 8 mechanisms that we can use to compare intelligence and all these different sorts of beings. What I'm planning to do in the book I'm going to start this summer is, in fact, to apply the same sort of thing to all the new kinds of generative AI. As I mentioned earlier, the report card's going to change, but I haven't figured out the extent to which it's going to change because I need to do much more systematic experiments with those machines to see what they can do and what they can't do. So far, I've just been astonished at how much they can do.
Well, let's go quickly through some of the chapters because a lot of the content of some of the subsequent chapters we've already been discussing, which is great. But I just do want to continue going through the book. So chapter 2 on prodigious people, chapter 3 on marvelous machines, you're dealing with some of the specific entities that we've been talking about and applying these the principles of attribution and comparison. So just give a flavor very quickly of each of those two chapters.
Okay, so and with machines, I picked some of the things that people would be very familiar with, like recommender systems. So everybody uses Netflix or Apple Music or Spotify. There's really interesting kind of AI operating in the background. So if you like one particular kind of song, it will say, well, try this one. Or try, if you like that movie, try this one. And so that I think is interesting. It's sort of intelligent, but it's doing a fairly primitive kind of analogical inference. But that's all it does. I mean, it doesn't rate very highly on the comparison procedure. If you look at other things that I talk about that are much smarter, like the new kinds of products of the company DeepMind, it's done actually some amazing things. For example, using deep learning to produce a system that can predict protein folding. This was a really hard problem that people can't solve with their heads and that machines weren't able to do. But using deep learning, they produced a system that does protein folding way better than us. So that got it way up in my reasoning criteria. So some of the things that we use are really impressive, like Google Translate. Google Translate is amazing because it can do pretty good translations into 100 different languages. And for some of those languages, like French, which is the only other language I know besides English, it does actually a really good job. So we've got these machines that do various sorts of things. But what needs to be done for that chapter, as I'm mentioning, is it has to be upgraded to take into account the new sorts of machines we have. But at least this illustrates for you how the comparative procedure can work, because we can not just say, oh, that sounds intelligent to me or not. We can actually look at the 12 features and the 8 mechanisms and try to figure out whether they operate in those different machines.
In chapter 3, which again was published 3 years ago, which means it was finalized maybe 4 years ago, you gave on consciousness and also emotions all Fs to the systems that you evaluated at that time. So right now today, although you're in the process of thinking about it, if you look at the large language modules, the ChatGPT, Bard, various ones being developed, where on the consciousness and emotion scales would you give it? Are they getting to D's instead of F's?
No, I think they're still F's, but it's a moving system. So consider emotions, for example. In order to figure out whether they've got emotions, you need to have a theory of emotions. Well, I actually have a theory of emotions. It's a neural theory that said when we have emotions, and I've got a bunch of publications on this, when we have emotions, what's happening is three different things. First of all, our brains are representing the situation because emotions are about something. So right now I'm happy that I'm talking to you. So it's about that. But you've also got other things going on, which is an appraisal, a judgment, and because this is accomplishing my goals. But also, and this is the key part that's missing in machines right now, it's also there are things going on in my body. I've got my heart rate and my breathing rate and my cortisol levels. And so what the brain does is to put these three kinds of representations together into a really rich kind of neural representation. And so when we have emotions, we're doing all three of those things. And right now, we can certainly have in the machines that were available then and are available now, representations of what's going on, and they can do appraisals. I've gotten ChatGPT to do some really good appraisals that can really help you with decision-making. Should I lease a car or should I buy a car? Mm. I didn't really know the answer to that question, and it gave me a really clear answer that sounded to me just right. But what it doesn't do is have the internal physiological things. It doesn't have a heart rate, or it doesn't have a breathing rate, or it doesn't have cortisol levels. But the question is, could it have something like that? And here's where the world is changing, because one of the major areas of research right now is finding ways to connect up the large language models or the generative AI models with robots, because robots are getting more sophisticated. And robots have bodies. Now, they're very different from human bodies. They don't have hearts and they don't have breathing, but they definitely have internal states. So the open question there, and I don't have the answer for it, I think this is something that's going to unfold over the next couple of years, is there going to be any similar kinds of messages coming from the bodies of the robots or the driverless cars that will give inputs to the new AI models that would give them something like the kinds of inputs that give emotional consciousness to humans? That, I think, is an open question. But as of right now, as for when I wrote the book, I think that the question of whether there are emotions and consciousness in these machines is still an F.
Okay. And do you see those moving in parallel, emotions and consciousness?
I think it's going to be it would really be more easy for a machine to have perceptual consciousness, because that just requires something like a camera and processing that's similar to what humans go. So I think there'll be perceptual consciousness in machines before there's sensations or emotions in machines. But the first easy one would be perception, because it's easy to hook up a machine like a robot to a camera. That's already done all the time. But would you have all the other kinds of operations that go on that are important for human consciousness? Consider, for example, competition. Human attention is very limited. And this is true of animals as well. We shift from one thing to another. You can't think of everything that's going on in your environment. But a machine with a huge memory may not have this kind of limitation. But our consciousness is very much tied in with the process of attention. And I think that's a big part of where our qualitative experiences come from. But you've got you may not have any reason to put that sort of attention into a machine. The new AI models use something called attention, but it has nothing to do with human attention. It's just a way that they describe how it manages to process vectors to handle relevance and context. So that has nothing to do with human attention. But human attention is really important to our consciousness because you shift from one thing to another.
Sure. Are you distinguishing between perception and perceptual consciousness? Seems like you're blurring that distinction.
Oh, no, I completely accept that because most of our perception is, in fact, unconscious. You've got all sorts of stuff coming on. You've probably heard of the cocktail party phenomenon where you're at a party and you hear blah, 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 blah. It's all going in the background. But someone mentions your name. Someone says Robert and whoops, then suddenly you're interested because it's about you. You didn't realize you were listening to the other conversations. So we're getting lots of perception below the level of consciousness. It requires the competition mechanism to select out what really matters to your goals.
Okay, and how would that apply to machines?
Well, there it's an interesting question. Humans need the attention mechanism because our consciousness is so limited. But if you've got a giant machine, if you look at the way in which these machines are running now, they're running on gigantic banks of computers run in the various cloud platforms, I mean, thousands of computers. And so maybe they don't have the same kinds of short-term limitations that come with the human brains. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? We don't really know. I mean, it's not clear whether our very limited consciousness is a good thing or not. I tend to think it's probably a good thing because it helps us to focus. That if right now you're getting all my attention, but if a brick came through my window, well, then my attention would shift completely over to that brick. And it's a good thing because that's a threat to me. And so if you're a biological organism and you need to survive and reproduce, it's really good that you've got this short-term capacity for consciousness that will shift you toward what you really need to be worried about at that moment. But the computers don't have that kind of threat. They're not biological. They don't have to survive and reproduce. And so they don't need that. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't think we really know. It may be that perception can go on in machines like ChatGPT without consciousness at all, once you hook it up to a camera, which is easy enough to do. But maybe, in fact, to be more intelligent, it would need to be more focused, and that would require something like consciousness. These are all things to be discovered by future experiments.
Sure. Going on, chapter 4, you deal with amazing animals. We've talked about bees and dogs, dolphins, chimpanzees. Very interesting characteristics of each one. As you said, it's a moving target because research is coming on. Chapter 5 on human advantages. Very quickly, what are the key elements that make humans superior or human uniqueness? Recursion in terms of the looping mind is something you talk about.
Yeah, this seems to be a relatively recent development in human cognition. The best guess, and the evidence is not rich, is that it happened around 100,000 years ago. So hominids have been around for a long time, going back to lots of different species. But humans seem to have gotten something quite amazing around this time. And no one knows what it was. And Chomsky seems to suggest it was a single genetic mutation, but we really don't know what the relevant genes are. But around 100,000 years ago, the human species acquired this wonderful package that is summed up by saying recursion. Well, what's recursion? Recursion is when you can embed things. I can say, I'm thinking, but I can say, well, I think that you think that I think that I think. And so you can build up all these more complicated kinds of sentences, which is a crucial part of language. But it's not just a part of language, it's also a part of vision. So you can make pictures of somebody who's holding a picture of somebody else holding a picture. And so you can have embedding there. It's also important in music, where you have different kinds of melodies embedded within melodies. So I think there's a lot of evidence that a big part of what makes humans smarter than other other animals is just way better capacity for recursion that turns up in language and other things. And that happened probably, as far as anyone can tell, maybe only about 100,000 years ago. It's at that point where you start to find these amazing things in human society. Suddenly you've got music, and suddenly you've got art, which is relatively recent in the development of hominids. So that seems to be a key part. So if you want to have full-blown human intelligence, you're going to need to have something like recursion. And that's, again, another way in which some of the current AI models are really interesting, because what the attention mechanism, as I said before, it has nothing to do with attention. It seems to be a really cool way to get recursion operating in a computer, to operate not just in the programming languages. We already had programming languages like Lisp that can do recursion, but to be able to have complex representations and make the representations about representations about representations. And ChatGPT does that really well. It clearly does recursion in lots of different areas, but whether it'll be up to the level of humans is still unknown. But that, I think, is one of the big advantages that humans got that make us not just smarter apes or smarter mammals or smarter biological systems, but way smarter, because it gave us language and the ability to think thoughts about thoughts that have huge social benefits, but also have huge benefits for creativity.
If that's the key to consciousness, then one would think that machines could rapidly exceed the human capacity for recursion.
Well, I think it's a key part of intelligence, but not for consciousness, because I think the dogs and cats are already conscious, even though their recursive abilities aren't very good. Dogs and cats don't recognize themselves in mirrors. They can't produce language. They can just produce simple sounds. They can't have embedded kinds of utterances the way people can. So mammals, besides humans, don't have much in the way of recursion, but they do have consciousness. But they just don't have the kinds of abstract consciousness that we're capable of.
So chapter 6, When Did Minds Begin, which begins to deal with the theories of consciousness and what consciousness is. Use some wonderful examples. Are cats and dogs jealous? The concept of grief. I think report I read recently where they discovered where elephants were burying their dead calves in some sense. That has been since... I remember when we had a pet dog, the dog would always bark angrily when family members hugged each other as opposed to dealing with the dog. I mean, it was a regular thing. And is that jealous? I mean, that's what we thought it was at the time.
But these are the kinds of cases where you have to apply the attribution procedure. That is, you've got to not just say, oh, my cute animal, they're just like me. There are people who think that dogs are humans or dogs are people. But you have to do the experiments and consider alternative explanations. When I started thinking about animal emotions, especially dogs and cats, I've got lots of friends who are very attached to their dogs and cats and talk to them like they're people. Well, you have to figure out, does this make sense? You have to look at the evidence. And there I started off really quite agnostic. I didn't have a strong opinion one way or the other. I was just skeptical. Show me the evidence. And I got convinced. I got convinced that emotions, not maybe all of human emotions, but a lot of human-like emotions operate in mammals. They get similar kinds of physiology, similar kinds of brains, and their behaviors are right. So I had to be convinced that that dogs and cats have emotions. Of course, my pet-owning friends would say, well, duh. It's not obvious. You got to look at the evidence. And some very smart experiments have been done to try to figure out whether the hypothesis that these animals have emotions is more plausible than the alternative one, which is that they're just sort of responding to their environment. Grief is really interesting with elephants. So I read, there's a whole book about grief in elephants, and I got convinced the behaviors are so wide-ranging that the analogy with human grief, when we lose somebody we care about, it just seemed really, really strong. And of course, it all fits at the explanatory coherence level with what the underlying mechanisms are, because the brains of these animals are very similar to us. They have brain areas like the amygdala that is responsible for a lot of these emotions in human beings. So both from neurophysiology and behavior, I became convinced, what I hadn't been before, that yes, you do have emotions in these animals.
I love the section where you deal with, I don't remember exactly, maybe 10 or more concepts of consciousness from one extreme that said at the beginning that consciousness was always forever because God exists and God is conscious, or if you're in an Eastern tradition that consciousness is pervasive and the ultimate, the ground of ultimate reality, to going through the different phylogenetic aspects, as we've already discussed, and you wind up with the last one being Julian Jaynes, who said that consciousness was the breakdown of the bicameral mind, you know, 3,000 years ago or some very recent time.
Yeah, that would make it purely cultural, but I don't think that's plausible. There's other possibilities.
He defined consciousness in a different way anyway, so that's sort of fun to talk about, but it's actually not terribly relevant.
And there's other views too. There's still some philosophers arguing for panpsychism. Panpsychism is the view that everything in the universe is conscious. Every subatomic particle is conscious. I think that's crazy. There's no evidence for that.
Yeah, but again, you use the term that they're still doing that. Actually, they're doing that more. It's not that they're still doing something they used to do. It's getting less and less. It's exactly the opposite. That in the last several decades, there are more and more analytic philosophers that are coming to some kind of conclusion like that.
I think that's a commentary.
You don't have the highest degree of admiration for analytic philosophy in general. So how do you deal with that?
Well, my view is highly naturalistic. I want philosophy to fit with the available science. And I've actually written critiques of standard methods in analytic philosophy. I've got one paper called Thought Experiments Considered Harmful, where I describe what's wrong with all the various ways that people in philosophy, in analytic philosophy of a particular sort, use thought experiments to reach their conclusions. Scientists use thought experiments, but for a different purpose. They generate hypotheses that way, which is perfectly good. That's how Einstein did it. But they realize that once you've got the hypothesis, you have to evaluate it. You have to look at the evidence. Whereas one branch of analytic philosophy, the non-naturalistic thought, thinks that once you've told the story and pumped your intuitions, that you've reached a good conclusion. And I think that's just not right. So the arguments for panpsychism, I think, are just really bad ones. Whereas the procedure that I'm suggesting, look at the evidence, look at the behavior, and then we can try to figure out just where consciousness ranges over these different kinds of animals and machines. But it certainly shouldn't apply to atomic particles.
And the argument back would be that you are self-limiting and that your approach is an analytic philosophical approach that you're criticizing. But what you're doing is using your own version of analytic philosophy to self-limit yourself.
Yeah. Well, here I can make a much broader argument about really about truth and about science. And I've done that in a number of different places. I think we've got really good reason to believe that over hundreds or thousands of years, science has made progress in getting access to the truth, to figure out how the world actually is. How has it done that? Well, it's using all the methods I talked about: observations, instruments, experiments, theory evaluation. This has really worked. How do we know it works? Well, I'm talking to you from thousands of miles or hundreds of miles away using machines that are based on electrons. How do we know there are electrons? Well, because they have these behaviors, and we can evaluate different theories of what's going on when we're talking over the computer. So there's really good reason for this position, which in philosophy is called scientific realism, that science gets an approximation to the truth a lot of the time. And how does it do that? Well, again, we've got lots of ideas of how this works because philosophers and historians of science, and often the scientists themselves, have described how these methods go. So these are good methods. Whereas if you look at the thought experiment method, the pure one where you reach your conclusions that way, it's just a very unreliable method. It's roughly about as reliable as listening to politicians and reading religious texts.
Well, the thought experiments don't come to a conclusion, but they allow you to question the fundamental assumption that you're making, that the only way to access truth is the naturalistic, physicalistic method. That's all they do. They don't come to the conclusion of what it is, but it is a way of contradicting what you've proposed as a naturalistic model.
Well, no, sometimes they actually make strong claims. I just read a book by a panpsychist. This is a book published last year, and he claims every particle is conscious.
Oh, sure.
And I don't think they're any good.
As John Searle told us, it's a thin layer of jam smeared over the entire universe. So we understand it, but I think in terms of the methodology, they may be coming to that conclusion. But the thought experiment is just loosening one sense of a naturalistic approach being the only way to access truth. I think that's the key of the thought experiments in analytic philosophy. And then what they may conclude goes on from that. They don't follow from the thought experiment, but they allow them to develop some other theories. So, Paul, your concluding two chapters deal with the application of some of the things we've been talking about. Chapter 7 is the morality of bots and beasts, and then Chapter 8 specifically deals with artificial intelligence and the ethics of it. So based on what we've talked about, I want to get into understanding of the moral relationship between how we as humans think of, for example, the golden rule, do unto others as you would have others do unto you, as you've articulated very well, and how that can apply to animals. My personal favorite way of distinguishing humans from other animals, and it's an oversimplification, but it's kind of fun, is the following thought, is that humans, we eat in public, but we have sex in private. Whereas many animals, like dogs, for example, will have sex in public, but they eat in private because they want to keep their food from being stolen by other animals.
I don't know whether that's true in general. I can't comment on that. Because there are some people who have sex in public at orgies, and I've certainly seen cats and dogs gobble up their food when other people are around just because they're hungry. So I'm not sure how the generalization works or not.
So, but how do you apply, for example, the questions of morality? If a lion kills a gazelle, we don't think that's immoral because that's not a moral question.
But the issues we're talking about are highly relevant to how we treat animals. So in Descartes' day, he thought that animals were just machines. He didn't think they had any kind of mind or consciousness or emotions. And so from that point of view, you can do them what you want. You don't have moral views toward your chair, for example. But once you see animals as capable of emotions and pain and possibly suffering, I think suffering is different from the other two, then you start to have to wonder about what are our obligations to them. Already the findings that I mentioned about crabs and lobsters are having some impact in Europe. Or the question is, should you just throw a lobster into a pot of boiling water? Old view is, oh no, it doesn't have any experience. It doesn't have any pain. But if you can realize that lobsters in fact have nociceptors, they have the same kind of pain receptors and they've got the neural capacity. And in fact, this was a really surprising thing. You discover that painkillers can make them behave differently because they're not in pain anymore. Then that kind of practice really has an impact on our moral judgments. So I think that increasing knowledge about other animals having the capacity for pain and negative emotions really does shift the way we think ethically about them, or at least it should shift the way that we do.
On the ethics of AI, you use analogy with medical ethics to apply as a way of thinking. How so?
This came about because about 5-10 years ago, a lot of people in AI started getting really worried about stronger AI models. And of course, it's become even more crucial since they've become smarter with the large language models. But the question is, what principles should be applied? And about 80 different companies started generating principles for AI ethics. And it was a credible mess. It was incredible hodgepodge. One of the best groups got together and they came up with 20. But why these principles? And they were all over the place. But it occurred to me, because I used to teach medical ethics, that the four principles of medical ethics could subsume all of them. These principles are beneficence, basically is be good to people, non-maleficence, which is basically just a clumsy way of saying don't cause harm, justice, which is mean treat people equally, and autonomy, which is keep freedom going. So you want to have do good, avoid harm, allow freedom and be just, which means fair across the distribution of different goods. And what I argue in that chapter is that those four principles actually cover all of the 80 or so AI principles that have been described. So the AI ethics previously was kind of what was and is a kind of mess, because the people coming out of AI work, and they're incredibly clever with their technology, but they often don't have any backgrounds in philosophy. They don't realize when they're reinventing the wheel. They don't realize what the alternative views are. And so they just generate something that makes sense to them. And it may not, in fact, be very useful for solving the problem which they want to solve, which is a huge, which is what are the ethical consequences of AI. So what I showed in that chapter is that these four basic principles, do good, avoid harm, allow freedom, and be just, really covered those AI principles really well. Why those four principles? Well, I derived them from something I think that is much more fundamental, because this is highly controversial within philosophy, because people argue about what the basis for ethics is. But I think it's basically human needs. Humans have biological and psychological needs, and all of these are objectively true. We can do experiments to show that people have these needs, and then we can use that as the basis for trying to decide how AI should develop. So I borrow from Gandhi a nice slogan, which is need, not greed. What's really scary about all the work in AI going on now is it's really based on greed. There's private companies that are going after the financial needs of their owners, their financial wants, their not needs, and they're also increasing the power of the people who develop them. Now, there are people who are saying, wait a minute, we got to slow down and think this through. But you need to have an ethically plausible way of thinking it through. And I think my four principles drawn from medical ethics and the principle of need rather than greed does that very well. It's become much more crucial since that book came out, because the prospects for doing more and more advanced things with the generative AI models are just enormous. Can I tell you a poem I got an AI to write that I think captures this fairly well? Sure. I asked Primod AI, it's one of the large language models, to write a poem about artificial intelligence. And it was quite a good poem. But the last couplet I particularly like, it was, this is what the AI wrote. Your circuits hum with thoughts so deep, we ponder, are we the shepherds or the sheep? So this is the AI writing it. It's telling us to consider whether we're being shepherds or sheep. Right now, we're shepherds. But people, including very serious researchers like Jeff Hinton, who's behind a lot of this technology, are really worried, because they see AI growing at a rate that could potentially turn human beings into sheep. So that's an ethical question. That would be get us to a place where human needs would not be met because the computer's doing what it wants. Already, much more immediately, we've got powerful figures who are building these machines for the sake of their own financial wants and power. And that could really be harmful to human beings. So the issues of AI that were sort of hypothetical when Bots and Beasts came out are now incredibly more intense. But I think the ethical framework that I developed in that last chapter provides a really good way of going after the contemporary issues as well as the ones that were current then.
Human history does not have a good record in using ethical concerns, however structured, to inhibit deleterious use of technology. So I'm not sure we're going to be able to make many changes or constraints because it's not a question of the majority doing it properly, following the four rules. It would be a question of everyone doing it, and that's highly unlikely.
So, well, that's what you need governments for. So already the European Union has brought in some quite plausible rules about controlling AI. There's an executive order coming out of the Biden government that is at least in the right direction. And people like Jeff Hinton and Joshua Bengio, another leading researcher, are pushing hard for governments to really come in here. We really need to have political control over what otherwise could be something that's quite disastrous for human beings.
Yeah, try applying that to just to pick a country, North Korea, and see how successful.
Or Russia. Russia is not a terribly ethical country, as you know, from its invasion of Ukraine. And that actually I find really scary.
Welcome to Closer to Truth's Rapid Fire Questions. I'm speaking with philosopher and cognitive science Paul Thagard. And I'm going to ask him a series of questions that will probe his understanding And please understand, he's only going to be given a few seconds for each answer. So his thinking is much broader than this, but we're going to subject him to this rapid fire test. Here we go. Paul, let's get into some of these short questions. Again, very, very short answers. Number one, what is the essence of consciousness?
If I had to give one word, I'd probably say awareness. But okay. I don't really believe in essences.
What is necessary for consciousness?
That has to be figured out. We can't do that just by a definition. We need a theory.
What is sufficient for consciousness?
Same thing. I think that four neural mechanisms are sufficient, but those are empirical questions. They're not definitional questions.
How do you distinguish necessary and sufficient for consciousness in driving your theory?
You have to look at the full range of things that we have good reason to believe are conscious, like humans and animals and possibly machines someday.
What are the simplest animals to which you would now attribute consciousness?
Crabs and lobsters.
Can AI ever be conscious as we are conscious?
I don't think it will be exactly like us, but it could be some approximation to it.
What does it mean to be an approximation to it? Is the fundamental question, is there an internal awareness, what it's like to be, in the famous phrase that you might not like?
I don't like it, because there's not something that it's like to be conscious. There's a million things that it likes to be conscious, involving different perceptions and sensations and so on. So some of those things, some of those what it's like may appear in machines eventually, but we just don't know yet.
Do you ascribe any truth to claims of extrasensory perception or parapsychology that violates what we consider physical law today?
No, those claims have been exposed as false.
Finally, do fish feel pain?
Probably yes.
And do dogs get jealous?
Probably yes.
Many thanks, Paul. It's been a great conversation. I look forward to more. I look forward to all your new books coming out. You have a standing invitation to come back to Closer to Truth when the books come out. Viewers can watch over 1,000 Closer to Truth videos and dozens of TV episodes on consciousness on the Closer to Truth website and YouTube channel. All facets of consciousness, brain mechanisms, free will, personal identity. Yes, panpsychism, we talk about that, dualism, idealism, a little parapsychology, but all with critical thinking. That is the hallmark of Closer to Truth. All is infused with critical thinking. Thank you, everyone, for watching. Thanks again, Paul.
Thank you very much. This was fun.
To watch complete conversations with over 100 of the world's leading thinkers on cosmos, consciousness, and meaning, visit our website, closertotruth.com.